Welcome everybody on this rainy morning. What I'm going to do today in the next sort of 45 minutes or an hour is talk about a couple of problems that are actually related, one of those being approximating sort of large quadratic forms. So you can think of large covariance matrices as an example. But the real emphasis is on the talk, and the talk is going to be approximating products of large matrices. And in a certain sense, this is kind of part one of what will be a common theme that I'll be talking about again at the end of the month in the workshop. So at the end of the month, I'll really focus on this quadratic forms problem on its own. Here, it's just kind of a nice tool that comes up in this problem of approximating matrix products. And this is joint work with Ali, who those of you who are around in January, February have already met, and he'll be back in another week or so, actually. So the first thing I'm going to do is just introduce the problem and explain to you sort of why it's important and how, in particular, the problem of computing matrix products can be related to spectral methods, so the eigendecomposition of a positive definite kernel. And then the last thing I'll do in this first part of the talk is introduce a notion called the Nystrom extension. This is something that comes from theory of integral equations, and it was used to approximate positive definite integral operators by reducing the problem to one of a finite dimensional eigendecomposition. So that's sort of the first third of the talk. The second third of the talk is going to be about this notion of matrix products and how they're related to low rank approximations. Okay, so here the idea is we're going to see that there's two problems that arise in approximating matrix products. There's a notion of rescaling terms in the product, and then a notion of which actual terms should be kept to do a good approximation. And in general, these problems are quite difficult to solve, but we're going to give some bounds and some algorithms, and so you'll get a flavor for the types of results that one can get. Okay. The third thing I'll do then is, having given some theorems about this, we'll show some empirical results, so we'll pick up some examples of matrices, the types that arise in signal processing applications like beamforming, and kind of show how these things work. So that's the structure of the talk, and by all means, please stop if you have questions. There won't really be enough time to prove the theorems, but I'm happy to stay after, and you know, we can do anything on the board. If people want to see more detail, I'm happy to do that. So basically, whether you're talking about computer science or engineering, signal processing, or even statistics, you know, evaluating products of large matrices is a pretty typical thing to do. I mean, this could be, you know, outer products of a bunch of Gaussian random vectors. This could be just a general matrix product problem. And of course, if you do this in the sort of textbook manner, then you pay, you know, sort of n cubed, if we just think of the matrices as being n by n for now. The best known algorithm, Coppersmith-Winograd, has complexity about n to the 2.38 asymptotically. There are some things in between 2.38 and 3, and the existence of order n squared algorithms is still an open question. So people in computer science like Kleinberg have conjectured as to whether or not such algorithms exist. This is a fundamental complexity class notion about matrix multiplication. So and there are even, if you're interested in the bulletin of the AMS in the last year or so, there was a nice sort of article about how these questions relate to algebraic geometry. So if you're interested in that, there's some recent literature sort of summarizing what's been done. The approach I'm going to take here is to approximate products by essentially sparsely sampling. I can write any matrix product as a sum of rank one operators. And so if I retain some of those rank one operators, but not all of them, then I can get an approximation to the overall product. So the first thing that's going to happen is I'll reduce the problem to actually one of approximating a positive definite kernel. This kernel arises from a Hadamard, or entry-wise product of matrices, in a way I'll show you in a minute. And then I'll give both randomized and deterministic algorithms together with these error bounds and experimental results sort of as promised. So that's kind of the strategy. So to give you a little bit more detail and make this problem sort of concrete and specific, let's take a matrix A that's n by n and a matrix B that's n by p, so that these are compatible in the sense that the product AB makes sense. And I'll use subscripts to denote columns and superscripts to denote rows. And I'm not going to bother too much with sort of transpose notation and so forth, but if you just look at this sum of rank one operators, it's clear that I can write the product AB by summing as I go from 1 to n, essentially the outer product or the columns, the ith column of A multiplying the ith row of B. I can sum these together, I get the product AB. So an approach to approximating this product is to say, well, what happens if I restrict to some subset of these n rows and columns? So I find some way to choose. You can think of this as akin to a problem of model selection. I find some way to choose a certain subset, say, of cardinality k. And instead of using the sum over I goes from 1 to n, I use the sum over some subset. And maybe I allow myself to optimally rescale the sum of rank 1 operators to get a better approximation. So this optimal rescaling problem I'll solve for you, and we'll talk about optimal row and column selection, so how to select the appropriate indices here in a good way. And what happens is that these questions both end up to being related to approximating an induced quadratic form that looks like the following. So I take A transpose A, entry-wise product with B, B transpose, and I call this result for now Q. Q is a quadratic form. Will depend only on a few properties of Hadamard products, but essentially you can just think of taking these two things and multiplying them together component-wise. So that's how this is going to work. We can do this way. So the first thing I have to do is explain how this approximation to Q is going to proceed. So you can think about this more generally as why am I interested in approximating large matrices in the first place, let alone products of matrices. Well, I mean, we're all here for high-dimensional data analysis, and we can quote many things about large P, small n, large P, large n, et cetera, et cetera. But even in, you know, ordinary engineering signal processing applications as well as computer science, you know, this comes up a lot. There are applications where one has arrays of sensors. They could be radar, sonar, even acoustic sensors. And the size of the matrix to be dealt with, there's a kind of Rayleigh quotient problem to solve, and the matrix size depends on the number of sensors. Image segmentation, low dimensional embeddings, the standard stuff, isomap, those family of multidimensional scaling algorithms. And I guess from a statistical perspective, somehow, to me, the key question is about the information content of the matrix. So what is the relevant information in our potentially very large data set or signal of interest? And if you think about it, one way to measure this amount of information is to look at the rank of the object under consideration. And so spectral methods basically reduce this question to finding some kind of low-rank approximation to a positive kernel, or an SPD matrix, I'll just say for short. So that's really the notion. And if you pick up anything from classical methods like principal components, even multidimensional scaling is really classical at this point, all the way to the sort of recent offshoots in the early 2000s, as I said, everything from isomap sort of on forward, they all depend on approximating a large kernel. And in PCA, the size of the kernel depends on the dimensionality of the data. In these newer methods, the size of the kernel depends on the cardinality of the data set, right? So classic machine learning problem, I have to deal with a Gram matrix or a kernel that depends exactly on the size of my training set. So when these matrices get large, it's typically not even possible to read them into memory contiguously, let alone sort of, you know, do the optimal, you know, invert them or compute singular values, singular vectors. So I'm just going to decompose Q into spectral coordinates. As is usual, columns of U are going to be eigenvectors. Q will admit an orthonormal set of these. And lambda is going to be a diagonal matrix that contains the eigenvalues on the main diagonal. And they're just going to be ordered non-increasingly. So lambda 1 is the largest, the principal eigenvalue. And of course, these are all bounded below by 0. So It's straightforward to show that for any matrix norm that's invariant to unitary operators, left or right multiplication by unitary operators, the best rank K approximation one can find to Q, I'll call it Q tilde, is to simply take the eigendecomposition of Q and truncate the n minus k smallest eigenvector eigenvalues and retain the k principal ones, standard thing. So Frobenius norm, spectral norm, plenty of other norms that are examples here. I'm going to stick in this talk with Frobenius norm. It's just going to be assumed. It makes things a little bit simpler. But the results I'm going to show translate in a reasonable way. So that's pretty much the basics. And in theory, this seems very easy. I mean, you pay n cubed to do this typically. Only the problem is if you do some of these experiments on your laptop or your desktop machine, you'll quickly see what happens. We have a nice cubic interpolation here of matrices of size 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. And it's easy to see that once you get to matrices of size n times 10 to the sixth, then it would take you more than 4 months to do the factorization. This isn't even getting into, you know, page swapping and so forth again. Like, just, you know, if you have a couple of gigs of RAM on your laptop, you know, you can read into, and you're clever with singles versus doubles, you know, you can read matrices on the size of maybe 5,000 by 5,000 into your favorite software programs. But once things get much bigger than that, you're just sort of kaput, right? And these operations don't parallelize terribly easily. It's not straightforward to write a parallel computing solution to doing eigendecompositions and things like this. So this is really the motivation for what I'm going to talk about. How do we take these very large dimensional data objects that may or may not contain a lot of information and ask in some sense about their implicit dimensionality? So what have people done? Well, a very typical trick is to simply sparsify the kernel. So declare a threshold epsilon and kill to zero all of the entries of Q that are less than epsilon, say an absolute value. And the questions, of course, are sort of, what have I done? How do I choose epsilon? If we're talking about the context of, say, shrinking a sample covariance matrix, this has recently some clearer interpretations. But it's not always clear just in the generic setting, you know, if I do this, you know, sort of what have I done? What have I done to eigenvalues and eigenvectors? So another approach, and in keeping with the model selection theme I started with before, is to knowingly discard some of the data. And there's a technique that I mentioned briefly before called the Nystrom extension that tells you exactly how to do this. If you pick a subset of the data that are of interest to you, the Nystrom extension will give you a recipe to put an approximant to the original matrix sort of back together. And the basic idea can be summarized in just two lines. You know that if Q is positive semi-definite, then it admits this Gram decomposition. I can write it as X transpose X, and I can think of the columns of X as being vectors, such that Q is now this Gram matrix with respect to these vectors, X1 through XN. I choose a subset of these vectors, I preserve them along with their correlations with everybody else, and basically I use these to put back together a low-rank approximation, Q tilde. So let me just describe to you in the next couple of slides how the mechanics of this Nystrom approximation actually work. And what we're going to recover, interestingly, is something that's well known from multivariate statistics, which is a sure complement. And I'll talk more about that when we get there. So in integral equations, one speaks of an SPD kernel in terms of something with compact support, kxy integral over 0, 1. I'm interested in discovering the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues of this kernel. Then what I can do is I can discretize this interval 0 through 1. The way I've done it here, we start at 0 and we end up with n plus 1 points, evenly spaced along the interval. And I form the Gram matrix of the resulting kernel evaluations, right? So if I do this with k points or m plus 1 points, I'm going to get m plus 1 squared entries in this matrix. And I can do the following thing. I'll solve this finite dimensional eigenvector eigenvalue problem where vi and lambda I superscript v are the eigenvector eigenvalue pairs associated now with k, with my finite dimensional kernel. And then I have, in a certain sense, something that can be extended to give an estimate of the ith eigenfunction simply by plugging in the kernel evaluation x to get f hat sub I of x, right? So you'll see, of course, the normalizing factor here comes into play, 1 over the corresponding eigenvalue of the finite dimensional problem, and the sum over the kernels evaluated at the m points xm, as well as the is the point of interest x, right? And so this has been, you know, long known. It's been used by folks also in machine learning. You know, there's a very clear connection to kernel methods here. But the intuition is somehow I use sort of partial information about the kernel to develop an easier problem to solve. I solve that problem sort of officially, the correct way, and then I extend the solution using complete knowledge of the kernel, sort of by plugging in here. So you can do the same thing in a finite dimensional setting. And this is what's going to recover for us the Schur complement. So let me explain how this is going to work. So without loss of generality, I'm going to look at k eigenvectors of an SPD matrix Q by decomposing and extending a k by k principal submatrix. And when I say without loss of generality, for now, I'm just going to assume that I'm interested in the leading principal submatrix of dimension k. Okay, it doesn't matter. Everything that you care about with quadratic forms is invariant to symmetric permutation. So this is just for ease of exposition. I could be talking about any k subset, but I'll take the first k elements. And so you see I'll have y transpose here. Z will be n by n minus k by n minus k. And my subject of interest is going to be qj, this thing that corresponds to index set or multi-index j given by the elements 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to k. Right? And what you should be thinking of already here is that somehow n is very large and k is relatively small, because we're going to end up taking an eigendecomposition of qj or an inversion of qj, and so I'm going to pay k cubed for that. So the whole point here is to avoid paying n cubed and instead pay something that depends on k cubed. Now, I can write down the full spectral decomposition of q. I'm not going to use it, but I will use the full spectral decomposition of q sub j. And let's see how this is going to work. I take the elements of the eigendecomposition of qj, and I take the eigenvectors uj, and I extend them by adding to this matrix y transpose uj lambda j inverse. And what happens is when I put back together u tilde lambda j u tilde transpose, you'll see from the matrix algebra that what happens is I get a result that agrees in 3 out of 4 subblocks with my original matrix Q. Where it doesn't agree is in the final subblock, where instead of z, which I had in my original matrix Q, I have now y transpose qj inverse y. Okay? And this just follows from this construction, just multiplying things out. Right? So that means if I measure the resultant approximation error in some norm, I look at q minus q tilde, then I'm looking at exactly z, which was in this position in my original matrix, minus y transpose qj inverse y. And this is exactly the norm of the Schur complement of qj and q. So I said this relates to multivariate statistics. If I have a Gaussian distributed random variable, vector-valued random variable, and I condition on part of it, and I ask about the covariance of the remainder, I will come up with exactly the Schur complement as the covariance form for the remaining random variables. So this can be related to notion of entropy, conditional entropy, the Gaussian being the distribution that maximizes entropy for fixed variance, and so on and so forth. So I won't go into more detail about that now, because while it's interesting, it's not sort of directly relevant for the things I want to show you in the rest of the time that we have. The main takeaway from this section should be, okay, there's something called the Nystrom method. If I do the Nystrom method, I'm basically approximating Q in this way, and the error that I incur can be written precisely as the error, or the norm rather, of the Schur complement of QJ and Q. And again, it wouldn't matter which index set I picked. There would just be some extra permutations in here to obscure this notation. So I've kept them out. So that's the first third of the talk. And basically, I told you why I care about matrix products. And I promised you that matrix products are going to be related to this notion of the Nystrom extension and approximating quadratic forms. So this quadratic form problem is of interest in and of itself. And that's going to be the subject of the talk I give later in June. So I won't say too much more about that for now. So how are these things related precisely? So I said before, you know, take A and B such that they can be multiplied, AB, and I'll write the product as the sum of rank one operators. And what I'm going to do is approximate this product by keeping and rescaling a few terms in the sum. So now my multi-index J, my subset J, becomes the index set into the rows, respectively columns, or columns, respectively rows of A and B that I'm going to keep. And I mean, it always seems like a good idea to allow ourselves to reweight because it's clear that this could improve the result. And so I'll allow myself to have scalar weights here associated with this sum. Okay? So you've got two problems now. Okay, well, how do I choose J? No, so there are n choose k possible k subsets, k multi-indices. How am I going to find a good one? Right? And the second term is conditioned on any way of choosing J, then can I solve the optimal rescaling problem? And the optimal rescaling problem I'll show you on the next page turns out to be related to a nice sort of projection property of this Nystrom extension. And I won't go into too much detail, but I'll show you at least how the result works. So the first theorem we have is just going to tell you, independently of which terms I choose to keep, what is the error incurred and how does the optimal rescaling work. So here's how this is going to go. For fixed J, we characterize the optimal rescaling as follows. Take this quadratic form Q, let it have, without loss of generality, the partition I showed earlier, and I'll define it element-wise as the product of the inner products of the ith, jth column of A and the ijth row of B, and this is, in fact, the same representation of the Hadamard product of A transpose A, B, B transpose that I showed you earlier. Now, J is going to be this, again, leading principal submatrix of dimension k by k without loss of generality. And now, if you specify the J for me, I will give you the best product approximation using these terms. And it indeed does look like this. And the weights are given by qj inverse times r. And r is given by summing as j goes from 1 to n over this corresponding, effectively, elements of Q, right? This is AI dotted with AJ, BI dotted with AJ. This is for fixed I. This gives me RI, and I'm summing as J goes from 1 to N, okay? So as I said, if we had more time and I wrote this down for you, you'd see that this comes from some kind of notion of a projector. And the more interesting thing, somehow, is that the error that's attained at this minimum is given by the following. If I set E to be the matrix whose entries are all equal to 1, then essentially AB minus AB tilde squared in Frobenius norm is equal to the trace of the sure complement that we saw before multiplying E. And effectively what that means is I have to take every element in the sure complement and sum them together. Okay? Now, it turns out that sure complements of positive definite matrices are positive definite. And so this error is definitely, this term is bounded below by 0. There's no worries there. And then I've just given you here again the definition of the sure complement. So remember, the whole notion is that qj is small somehow. It's k by k. Z is n minus k by n minus k. So I don't want to deal with the sure complement. I mean, I want to characterize it, but I don't actually have to want to deal with it. Otherwise, I won't have really solved the problem of saving computation. Right? So now I have a way to get a handle on this error. So if I can characterize the maximal element in the sure complement, the sum of the elements in the sure complement, et cetera, I will have done something. So let's see how this is going to work. Well, I have a method now for approximating the product if you tell me which rows and columns you want to keep. I can characterize the error for you. And I can, of course, characterize the best subset J of cardinality K as that which minimizes this trace term, which again, remember, is the sum of all the elements in the sure complement. Okay? So what you're really looking for, then, if you rewrite this thing as a quadratic form, is a subset whose associated sure complement has the lowest possible power along this particular one-dimensional subspace that's spanned by the vector of all ones. If I left multiply, right multiply by this and its transpose, I will obtain the same expression. right? So I'm going to give two approaches to solve this problem. One's going to be based on a random choice of subsets. This has much of the feel of a classical computer science random sampling algorithm. And I'm going to give a second approach that's it's essentially like a greedy stepwise approach, which gives a worst case error bound. So of course, I give something up in the bound here, but I get, in a certain sense, an even simpler algorithmic protocol. OK, so let's look at this error term one more time. I've got in squared Frobenius norm, you know, so the sum of the squares of the elements of AB minus AB tilde is equal to the sum of all the terms in the Schur complement with respect to this thing Q that's this Hadamard product of A transpose A, B, B transpose. Now, I'm interested in bounding this, so I know that the Schur complement is positive definite, and I can look at its trace. The trace is the sum of the eigenvalues. So the sum of the eigenvalues is definitely at least as large as the largest eigenvalue. So I'll rewrite this term as I described before. I will pull out a bound with respect to the spectral norm, and then I'll finally get something that's n minus k times the trace of the Schur complement. So now it's clear that I just need to look at the trace of the Schur complement. And this bound is tight. If the Schur complement is proportional to the matrix whose entries are entirely 1, then the bound is then equality is achieved here. Okay. So now my problem, my subset selection problem, has been turned into one of effectively minimizing the trace of the Schur complement. Again, I don't want to deal with the Schur complement explicitly. I just want to characterize what I can say about the error. Okay, so first attempt at this is going to be a randomized algorithm, and it's going to work in the following way. I'm going to define a probability distribution that I assume I can sample from, and I'm going to bound the expected error. So recall that I have this matrix Q, and now element-wise, Q is this Hadamard product, so element-wise, it's a product of these inner products of columns of A and rows of B. Now, by the Schur theorem, the Hadamard product of two positive definite matrices is also positive definite, and this implies that there exists a matrix X such that Q can be written as X transpose X. This is the Gram decomposition I showed earlier, and it also implies that all of the principal minors of Q are positive, or at least non-negative. Right? So that means I can define a probability distribution over all multi-indices or index sets having cardinality k in proportion to the determinant of the chosen principal submatrix Qj. Okay? So I have exactly n choose k elements. You know, this distribution has support n choose k. It's discrete, and it's already everywhere positive or everywhere non-negative. And I just need a normalizing constant to make it a normalized measure. So nothing too fancy here. Just note that I can do this. I'm allowed to do this by properties of positive definite matrices. So if you're interested in multilinear algebra, there's a kind of deeper structure to what's going on here. If I take Q and I look at K subsets of Q and I form a matrix of the determinants of all these K subsets, I get what's called the Kth compound matrix of Q. So if I take one subset, I'll get something that will, in a certain sense, reduce to the trace. If I take n subsets, I will get just the determinant of Q entirely. And here I'm talking about taking k subsets. So the diagonal element of the matrix whose elements are all determinants of not necessarily principal k subsets of Q are given by these determinants of Qj. Okay, I'm choosing the Q is symmetric, so I'm choosing rows and columns at the same time. So I'm looking right down the diagonal of the so-called Kth compound matrix of Q. And if you're interested in these tensor products, it's very nice. You can recover the adjugate or the adjoint, you know, the thing that you transpose to compute the inverse by hand. All these kind of things. It's related to symmetric polynomials, and I won't go any farther with that here. But I will borrow a bound that we have from an earlier paper. And this comes from the Cauchy-Binet theorem, which is specifically about compound matrices and how to diagonalize them. And another lemma that characterizes the Schur complement, we were looking before at the trace of the Schur complement of Qj. And I can show that if I choose a multi-index j of cardinality k with probability proportional to this determinant of qj, then I will pay an expectation, a cost that's k plus 1 times effectively the L1 norm of the smallest n minus k eigenvalues, right? So I'm taking now, I goes from k plus 1 to n, I'm counting up the n minus k smallest eigenvalues of q. And relative to what we've been able to find in the matrix approximation literature, this appears to be the first such bound for these types of kernels, right? So really what you're paying here is something that depends on the L1 norm of the n minus k smallest eigenvalues, whereas if you were able to compute the eigendecomposition directly, you would pay according to the L2 norm of the n minus k smallest eigenvalues, you know, the square root of the sum of the squares of these guys. Okay. So that's that. And I'm going to, without going into the proof of that bound, I'm going to just give you our expected error in terms of matrix products. I've got Q can be decomposed as X transpose X, and I can apply the bound from the preceding theorem to get something that depends on the Frobenius norm of X minus XK, where XK is the optimal rank K approximant. So again, this is just the, effectively again, the L1 norm of the N minus K smallest eigenvalues of Q. And the thing that's a bit unfortunate here, why I'm a little bit less excited about this type of bound than the one on the previous page, is you can see the n doesn't appear in here explicitly. But in this means of calculating matrix products, we're paying according to root of n minus k. So this in theoretical computer science would be considered not as nice a result because I still have n minus k showing up in the bound. And that's just kind of unfortunate. But we've already proved that we've got the optimal rescaling given a choice of subset. So now the game is about how to choose subsets. If I choose subsets in this way, I can get a bound, but the bound has root of n minus k appearing in it. And I can use majorization results to further refine this term, but that's a little bit less interesting because I can't get rid of the n minus k. So it turns out that, of course, you can't just sample in proportion to these determinants. But you can write a pretty simple MCMC kernel that will do it for you. We haven't gone to the trouble of proving convergence rates of such a kernel. That's kind of an activity unto itself. But we simulated an awful lot. And empirically, a total variation norm seemed to decrease quite quickly. So we feel pretty good about this. So it can be done. Suffice it to say, it can be realized. Now, if you're feeling like you would like something that is more deterministic or more sort of greedy in spirit, then we can bound for you the maximal error rather than the average error. And of course, I'm going to give up something here, but let's take a look at what this looks like. The error term is the sum of all the terms in the Schur complement. Okay, so if I can at least get a handle on the largest term of the Schur complement, then I'll get a type of minimax bound. And then this even can be refined. So the first result is I look at the largest entry in the Schur complement, and I can show fairly straightforwardly that it's smaller than the largest diagonal element of Z. Okay. So Z now is the n minus k by n minus k submatrix that I didn't touch. And this suggests to me that if I want to minimize the largest entry in the Schur complement, then I had better make sure that the diagonal elements of Z are as small as possible. Okay? So this means that I choose my K subset, my multi-index, by picking the largest diagonal terms in Q, on the main diagonal of Q. Okay? So essentially, I take the L2 norm of columns of A, multiply respectively by the L2 norm of rows of B, and I look at which one of these are maximum. I sort these. You know, I pay n log k to sort these things. And I take the k largest. Then I can refine this result here to get a bound on the error in Frobenius norm that depends again on the root of n minus k. And now the sum of these diagonal terms for the elements that I have not selected. So the sum over all I not in the j subset. And remember, the whole strategy was to somehow make these things as small as possible. And that's as good as one can do. This bound is also tight, so this is as good as one can do, choosing greedily. you simply make this summation, the sum end, as small as possible by choosing choosing J to contain indices of the k largest diagonal terms. Okay, so essentially, these results are not that hard to show. You just need a few, again, lemmas about sure complements. And I think what's kind of really interesting here is, you know, I've got a couple of algorithms now for approximating matrix products. I could just have AB be the outer product of some vectors, right? That could be random Gaussian random vectors. And in fact, we've experimented with this, and I'll talk about it a little bit at the end. So one last thing. Everything I've done so far kind of used knowledge of A and B to do the subset selection. But I don't even have to do that. If I want to be somehow even less adaptive or completely non-adaptive, then I can appeal to Johnson-Lindenstrauss, and it will give me a very simple algorithm to reduce the dimensionality of the problem. So essentially what this lemma says, or one version of the lemma says, that if I take a matrix with IID unit normal entries, and it'll have dimension k by n, then I can down-project points in Rn to points in Rk, and with high probability, I incur very little error. So effectively, angles or correlations between points are well-preserved. Distances between points are also well-preserved. So matrix products are nothing more than a bunch of inner products between row and column vectors. So now I look at the ith row of A and the jth column of B, and clearly the ijth element of AB is the inner product of AI and BJ. And so if I'm interested in doing a non-adaptive reduction of this problem, then I can approximate AB by doing a so-called Johnson-Lindenstrauss transform or random linear projection applied to respectively A and B. And this should yield a good approximation with high probability. Okay? So my point in setting this up is just that, you know, we have done something that's adaptive. One could do something that's non-adaptive. Of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and somehow when you do this empirically, you do worse. And we'll see that in a minute. So that was the brunt of the talk, and now I'm just going to finish by giving some numerical results and talking a little bit about implementing these types of algorithms. So the questions are along the lines of the following. I gave some algorithms and some bounds. It's fair to ask about the complexity. And it's also fair to ask, I didn't put any measures on the input space, so how do I know in practical terms, even though these bounds are tight, how do I know how well they work for typical matrices, matrix ensembles of interest? And I have to say, the reason I haven't gone down this path too much yet is we did pick up this line of work from people in computer science, and they typically are interested in worst-case analysis, and so putting a measure on the input space is not something that's as natural as it would be in our discipline. So let me talk about this now, and then we'll finish up. And here's how this is going to go. So just a few sets of experiments to give you a flavor for how these methods perform. I'm going to look at four different subset selection methods, and I'm going to look at a couple of different rescaling methods. So I could do a uniform sampling on K subsets. That's pretty trivial, and it makes a nice sort of baseline. So I just choose one of the n choose K subsets at random, and I do the thing. I could sample according to the row powers. This is a method that was introduced by Drenius and others in 06. I could sample in proportion to the K principal minors. That's the corresponds to the first bound I showed today. Or I could do this greedy subset selection method that I just finished describing to you. And if you work out the computational complexity of this, you pay k cubed because you have to do an inverse of your qj. And you play mn plus mk squared to calculate the other elements you need, principally the elements of q itself and the elements of the optimal reweighting. So we looked at the optimal reweighting scheme, and the other one is another method that's been proposed by Drenius. They sampled according to row powers, and then they also reweighted according to, here, the reciprocal of the row powers. And they were able to prove a result for this type of matrix approximation, so let's see how it works. So first set of experiments, of course, if I'm going to simulate, I have to pick some matrix ensemble. And what we did for the first set of experiments was to let A and B have independent unit normal entries. So I took 60 by 15 and 15 by 90 and drew 200 random matrices in this way. And what you're looking at is errors have been averaged over the randomized algorithm for 20 trials per matrix product. And I'm reporting here the engineer's version of mean square error, which is simply the effectively the logarithm of the mean square error reported in decibels base 10, 20 log 10. And as expected, if I just uniformly sample on k subsets, and in fact I do the power rescaling, then I'm performing the worst here. Okay, this is the top curve in red. If I do the power sampling proposed by Drenius and I do the power rescaling, then I'm doing a bit better. And if I do the determinant sampling I described to you earlier by way of a MCMC kernel, also doing the power rescaling, I do a bit better still. It turns out in this case, if I actually do the greedy selection and the power rescaling, I'm doing the best of all. Okay. So for this particular matrix ensemble, this is the empirical ordering of these types of bounds for this set of examples. Okay. So those all had this power rescaling, which we know is not the optimal rescaling term. Right? So I'm summing rank one operators, and I'm reweighting them, but I'm not reweighting them or rescaling them in the way that I know is the best. Right? So as I flip to the next slide, I've kept the axes the same, and you'll see all these curves drop a bit. Okay, so exactly this is what happened. We've dropped by a couple of dB. Now I'm looking again at the order here is preserved, uniform power, determinant, and greedy sampling, but now all with the optimal rescaling effect. So the performance in this case is better overall, as expected, because I know that I've done the best possible thing here, but the ordering of the methods is unchanged. So same kind of matrices, same matrix ensemble, same set of experiments, just showing you the effect of the rescaling. Okay? So just to finish up, I'll show you one last example. And this compares this greedy subset selection method by either rescaling with two non-adaptive methods. So choosing subsets uniformly at random and rescaling by n over k, and this method I described to you a few slides ago, computing random projections a la Johnson-Lindenstrauss. And so Johnson-Lindenstrauss is doing the worst here, which is fair because it's a completely non-adaptive method. We don't pay anything to look at A and B and compute any sort of optimal rescaling. We just rely on the notion that it's possible to project points from n-dimensional space down to k-dimensional space. If k is sort of order log n, we haven't lost too much. Right. So this gives you the error bounds for Johnson-Lindenstrauss. The second worst is uniform sampling with uniform rescaling. That's, again, maybe the simplest thing that you could think of to do. And then we look at our greedy sampling scheme with the non-optimal rescaling is still doing much better. And if you go ahead and pay for the optimal rescaling, you kind of get another dB better of performance. So this just gives you a sense of how much you're gaining by looking at adaptive versus non-adaptive methods. It's also quite clear here that uniformly sampling on k subsets, there's no reason to believe this should work well, and of course it doesn't. So that's it. So just to recap, a bit of careful analysis can begin to establish trade-offs between the computational complexity you're willing to pay to operate on large matrices and the resultant precision that you get. And this could just be in the context of quadratic forms. Here we went through quadratic forms to get at matrix products. So effectively, the takeaways are condition on a choice of subset. We can give you the optimal rescaling term. So you pick a subset, I can tell you how best to rescale. Two alternative strategies were given for subset selection. So how do I actually do the subset selection? They both rely on the Nystrom method of a particular quadratic form. And one of them was randomized, one of them was greedy. The error bounds were given, and each of them induces very straightforward algorithms that are simple to code up and implement. And then I finished with some brief simulation studies. What I'm interested in doing next is dropping the requirement that we don't put a measure on the input space and saying, okay, so if we deal with the space of Wishart matrices, et cetera, et cetera, my supposition is that these worst case sets have measure near zero, so the bound should be able to be tightened considerably. That's my conjecture. And the other thing we're doing is applying these to practical problems. So one example from a workshop I was at just a week ago is if I have a linear array of sensors, microphones, hydrophones, radar antenna, so on and so forth, then there's a Rayleigh quotient type problem that arises when I want to receive an impinging plane wave on the array and estimate certain properties of it. And these days, people are building very large arrays. A ship can tow a hydrophone array, a sonar array that has 500 elements. And the signal processing on board the corresponding chips does not permit paying 500 cubed operations to compute, you know, some type of Rayleigh quotient term. So we've implemented these methods, and they actually seem quite promising in this context. Again, there, one typically makes assumptions on the input space, and so it's probably possible to get a much better handle on what these bounds actually are for matrix ensembles of interest. So I'll stop there, and thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions. Yep?
Just thinking about some of the problems that people have in machine learning, like gastric processes are quite a classic area for this. So people have looked at, you know, a while ago, this sort of Nystrom-style techniques for gastric process prediction. And, they kind of came to the conclusion, at least in that field, that they didn't work as well as a bunch of other subsequently developed techniques, which I can't remember now. But, but I'm just kind of curious, because it might be that this sort of Nystrom method is a fairly generic technique, but for a particular application, there might always be something, you know, preferable to that, because it exploits the structure of the problem that you're actually interested in. So I'm just a little bit, you know, maybe you've got some comments about whether or not you think this is really going to, you know, is it just a kind of a general purpose sort of reasonable technique?
So I think there's two important points there. In a certain sense, one of them relates to what I said before. If you're able to tell me something quite specific about, say, the ensemble of covariance matrices of interest, I can either probably tighten the bounds or I can derive methods that are more tailored to this particular case. The second thing, I think, is it also depends what you're interested in. So in a certain way, I don't really like taking quadratic forms and using spectral or Frobenius norms, because matrices that are strictly positive definite, there's a Riemannian manifold structure, and there's a natural, you can write down the geodesic, the Riemannian metric in this case, and in a certain sense, it has nothing to do with Frobenius norm, because it puts the boundaries of the cone of symmetric positive definite matrices away at infinity, right? I mean, there's no, you know, any of these methods, you're going to get some eigenvalue zero because you're doing a low rank approximation. In a matrix that's truly positive definite, has no zero eigenvalues, it has a totally different geometric structure. And so in a certain sense, I'm not really sure what the best thing to do is, but another way to interpret your question could be, you know, are we using the right norms to measure performance? Like, do I really care about Frobenius? I mean, I can show you that if I can squeeze down the trace, I'll squeeze down the Frobenius and I'll squeeze down the spectral norm. And a theorem of Weyl tells me that if I squeeze down the spectral norm, then I've squeezed down the difference between the two largest eigenvalues of these two matrices. So in a certain sense, if you took like an asymptotic statistics approach, you'd write another page and you'd be like, okay, so we see that, et cetera, et cetera. As I get close in trace, I get close in Frobenius, I get close in spectral, and I get close everywhere. And the problem is solved. But for finite sample cases, I think it's very much like you say, that there's kind of one of the things I'm also interested in is somehow what are the right metrics? I mean, I mentioned entropy at the beginning of the talk. So it's known that choosing the K subset with maximal determinant is NP complete. Is entropy a good notion to use? Is Frobenius norm the right notion? I don't know the answer to these questions yet. I don't even know how much it's going to depend on applications. Again, in a certain sense, grabbing a unitarily invariant norm makes sense from a extrinsic Euclidean linear algebra perspective. But in any particular problem, it could be that you care about something very specific. I mean, you could care about the gap. Maybe you want a way to get at the gap. I mean, again, the file stuff gives you that, but you know, you might want to tell what you're going after. So I'm not sure. Just to finish off on that comment, I have seen some of the stuff in machine learning from a few years ago where people do the Nystrom and they do the thresholding, and I know it's common also in graphs. But I'm not up to speed on what the latest things are people are doing in Gaussian processes, so I'd be interested to chat with you about that, because maybe it's possible to at least give some bounds there and say something about what people are able to do. Any other questions?
Right at the beginning, you said that people had assessed the computational complexity of matrix product and got to big O of 2.38.
Yes.
Well, the possibility of big O n squared, that's quite a gap.
Yes.
Do you think people will, are people trying to aim directly for big O n squared, or are they trying to chip away at the 2.38?
Well, there have been, at last count, something like 40 refinements to the 2.38 result. And so other people have conjectured that no fastest algorithm exists, that somehow the set is open or something. I mean, you have to pay n squared just to touch every entry in the matrix once. And so in a certain sense, I mean, there's problems. If you would speak to the folks who were here at the end of March, like Fries and Cannon and these fellows in computer science, they would tell you that there's very little space to play here from a computer science viewpoint. I mean, you've got n cubed for doing the trivial thing, and n squared, which looks almost impossible somehow. So there's very little space to play, but what people in that literature have done instead is just try to understand kind of in more asymptotic terms, you know, is there some unifying theory for why this should be the case? So there's a log base 2 of 7, n to the log base 2 of 7, which is slightly larger than 2.38. And it comes from somebody who was busy trying to prove that this couldn't be done and discovered a formula for 2 by 2 matrices that takes 7 operations. So if you can do 2 by 2 matrices in 7 operations, then you can do n to the log base 2 of 7. So I think it's fair to say there's not really enough unifying theory yet for people to even know. And these are literally, people have posed in the past couple of years conjectures about whether such algorithms exist, but I mean, it's not that active of an area. There are people in it who are very good, but it's not like their papers are getting, it hasn't spawned its whole kind of subfield. I think that even the stability of this Coppersmith-Winograd algorithm is not, like, I mean, when you go implement on a computer, you have to be worried about lots of things besides just the speed, and the constant out in front is very large. And that, again, anytime you look at this type of big O analysis, you know, you have to ask, you know, well, n squared, but, you know, maybe I have to get a matrices that are a billion by a billion before the constants are making me equal to the other case. So I think it really is truly an open question. I don't think there's enough of a unifying framework for people to even conjecture reasonably about whether the answer is positive or negative. The same algorithms, by the way, can be used to do eigen and eigen decomposition matrix inverses. But the standard thing people use is still sort of Gaussian elimination. And if the matrix has lots of zeros, then you can save time and space. And that motivated the example I showed at the beginning of the talk, where I said, well, you could just threshold and you could cut the small components to zero and just forget about it. Anything else? Ian, did you have a question?
I could maybe comment about the Gaussian process stuff, but...
Oh, yeah, well, just if it's... I mean, please, like...
Okay, so I have been reading the more recent literature, and the comment is that perhaps they're doing something that's a bit different. So their approximations look as though they have a similar structure when you write down sort of the equivalent pictures to your block pictures of Q. But really, I don't think they're looking to minimize some norm with the true covariance matrix. What they're really doing is saying, this enormous object is a difficult thing to chase, and embarrassing things happen when we do the Nystrom approach because we might not get a positive definite answer and we have problems. So instead what they do is they just go back to their original problem and change that problem. So they write down a different model in their original Gaussian process and solve that. And it might along the way look as though it's an approximation, but really there are no guarantees about element-wise matching or, you know, under any norm approximating the original answer, the actual matrix. What they care about is their predictions making sense right at the end.
I see. So in a certain sense, there's two pieces. You change the problem so you don't have to deal with a large covariance form, and then you're interested in somehow the projection in a particular direction at the end of the day, or like you're interested in the action of the matrix maybe in a particular subspace or something like this. I mean, is it not even that?
Yeah,
clear.
It's that sort of thing.
I see.
I mean, my experience has been that any algorithm that tries to bound the norm of the covariance matrix in order to get that to within some reasonable error tolerance, you might end up spending more time than the naive algorithm.
In this particular
context. But it's sort of an interesting question of, in general, if you've got a really hard problem, is it really hard because you're doing the wrong thing? And might you be able to just sort of change your question slightly to get an easier matrix to deal with?
Or is
the best approach to write down a straightforward approach and then like try and numerically approximate it?
This will be in the talk in a couple of weeks, but you can show, for instance, that if your underlying object is if your underlying matrix is of rank k, and you pick a full rank subset of rank k, then Nystrom will give you somehow perfect reconstruction. So, the method is somehow sensible in a generic way because it tells you that if your true object really has low rank, then you'll recover the true object. But that's a kind of lossless compression anyway, right? I mean, that's just telling you that you really didn't need any other information here. It's sufficient to reconstruct the matrix just by knowing these three subblocks. So I think I could imagine in a Gaussian process kind of problem, maybe if you think harder about the correlation structure of your variables or something, you can sort of get rid of, maybe you can do some of that stuff ahead of time without asking it of an approximation procedure. But I'd be curious, I'll talk to you guys after because I'd like to read a little bit of this and see what's happening in this literature. Okay, anybody else? Thanks very much.